The 77th Academy Awards airs a week from Sunday. Five of the names nominated in the Best Acting categories are African American. Whether they win or not, this year's Oscars will have made history for having the most African Americans ever nominated in one year. The achievement confirms what Denzel Washington and Halle Berry's Best Acting Oscars signaled in 2002, that African Americans are an integral part of the new Hollywood elite. But their place at the top is due in large part to the efforts of pioneers like Hattie McDaniel and Bill Bojangles Robinson and many others. In the early days of Hollywood, they carved out careers for themselves, taking acting roles as the mammy or the butler. They also helped create a parallel world called Black Hollywood. There are stars that lived on Central Avenue but not in Beverly Hills, and they acted as maids but were not employed as such. This hour we talk with author Donald Bogle, who explores the little-known world in his latest book, Bright Boulevard's Bold Dreams, The Story of Black Hollywood. What do you know about Hollywood in the days of segregation? Do you have a favorite African-American actor or director from the early days you want to talk about? And what does all of this say about the evolution of film and American culture? Join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Donald Bogle joins us from member station KPCC in Pasadena, California. Donald, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be here.
What inspired you to write this book?
Well, you know, I've been writing about African Americans in the movies and in television for some time now. My first book, Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies, and Bucks, An Interpretive History of Blacks in American Films, dealt very much with images of African Americans on the screen and the type of stereotype roles the actors had to play. And my book, Primetime Blues, dealt with African American images on television from the early days to the present. And in both of those books, I tried very much to deal with the talents of the performers and the covert messages that they were sending out to audiences, how they often played against the stereotype. Mm. But nonetheless, with this book, I wanted to do something different. I wanted to look at, one, the way that African Americans really fought to make a place for themselves in the movie industry. Two, what happened once they made that place, what they were confronted with. And three, this whole community that existed, a place where African Americans lived together, socialized together, played together, griped about the industry together. But also the very, very difference between those roles on screen and the way that these people looked at themselves off screen. And I wanted to trace it back to the very beginnings when Hollywood was first taking shape in the early years of the 20th century. And I found it quite interesting that from the very beginning there was an African-American presence.
You talked about that. It is interesting. And the city of L.A. itself was founded by more than half of the population at its founding was African-American, am I right?
Were people of color, yes,
yeah.
Very much so. And at one time, very early on, it had been a rather free and open society, but later it did change.
I was going to ask you how comfortable a place it was in the early days for African-Americans. Now, we were talking about 1781 at its founding or around then. But in the early part of the 20th century, how comfortable a place was it for African-Americans?
Well, it starts to change as there are more African-Americans coming into the city and coming here to live, to work, and there was this kind of fear of large numbers of African Americans. And what happened in Los Angeles was that there were these restrictive housing covenants, which in essence prevented people of color from living in certain areas of the city. And those covenants were in effect in the 20s, in the 30s, really, they were not struck down to after the Second World War. So Los Angeles, in many respects, it wasn't like the South where there were signs for whites, for colored. But there were very much these racial lines that were drawn and racial codes. Mm. So people living in the city very much had to deal with that and navigate their way around those lines and also fight to get those lines taken down.
I'm talking with Donald Bogle, the author of Bright Boulevard's Bold Dreams, The Story of Black Hollywood. Donald, you begin and end your book with a woman who called herself Madame Sultawan. And tell us about her and why she's really the beginning and end of your story.
Well, Madame or Madame Sultawan was quite a character. I mean, she's really a fascinating woman. And I mean, I had to dig like everything to get information on her. But I'll tell you this about her. The name Madame Sultanwan, of course, that was not her real name. Mm-hmm. Her real name was actually Nellie Conley. She'd been born in Kentucky, and she came to Los Angeles with her children and her husband. They were outside of Los Angeles in the beginning. In the teens of the 20th century, she had been a performer. Her husband left her. She had to find work, and she sought movie work, and she struck up a friendship with, of all people, D.W. Griffith, the director of Birth of a Nation, a film that's considered to be an American masterpiece and also a racist masterpiece. But Madame, getting to Los Angeles, I mean, once working in movies, I mean, this was a place where people, black and white, did decide to reinvent themselves. And so she was no longer Nellie Conley. She was Madame. And that's how people had to address her. I came across a comment made by Lillian Gish, who had appeared in Birth of a Nation. And she said that, you know, we never knew where that name came from. But we just, that's what we called her. Yeah. But nonetheless, she began working for Griffith. She cleaned out dressing rooms. And she did play bit parts in Birth of a Nation. For those who see Birth of a Nation today, they'll note that the major black roles in the film were played by white actors in blackface. The idea that African Americans couldn't even play themselves in these big roles. But Madame and other black actors did play small parts, and nonetheless, she did get into the industry, and she kept working for decades, doing bit parts, sometimes doing supporting parts, and she was a very, very colorful woman off screen, and she was well known within the black community. But she indicates that there can be some kind of place for African Americans in the movie industry. And there are others who come, some who work as servants for the big stars. There's also a man by the name of Noble Johnson, a very handsome black actor who worked in silent films and who had a long career playing bits, supporting roles, and not always playing African Americans. And the interesting thing about Noble Johnson, and this is very early on in the 20th century, Noble Johnson playing these big parts in Hollywood films realized there was an African-American audience out there that wanted to see its own movies. And he helped found the Lincoln Motion Picture Company, which turned out race movies. And race movies were black cast films made for the African-American audience. And this is by 1916, 1917. That's very, very early. And it really shows his foresight. The company was not able to hold on for very long, but it was there, and it was an important part of the Los Angeles community at that time.
Why do you think race movies didn't do as well as so-called race music?
Well, you know, it's movies is that whole thing of financing movies and distributing movies and getting them shown in theaters. And the race movies turned up in, you know, they would play in certain urban areas, black neighborhoods, sometimes in the South and in black belts. But it was always the problem of financing. And then the whole thing of putting a movie together. You know, the thing that Hollywood did do was that Hollywood just became this great factory system. And Hollywood films were known for their production values. And Hollywood films eventually, because they were such a money-making machine, you know, they could shoot a scene 10 or 15 times if it didn't go right. And with race movies, that wasn't the case. I mean, money was always the problem. And then when sound movies came in, it was all the more difficult because sound movies, this new technology, a lot of those early race movie companies died, although new ones did spring up. But nonetheless, Noble Johnson does tell us something else about black Hollywood in the early years of the 20th century. And one of the things that really impressed me as I worked on the book. I mean, a lot of things I knew, but new things I was learning. Just decade after decade, more people coming in, more people going through barriers that were there. You know, a lot of people think that Bright Boulevard's Bold Dreams may just deal with stars, and it does. It deals with Lena Horne. It deals with Dorothy Dandridge, Sammy Davis Jr., Hattie McDaniel. But I also deal with these people who worked behind the scenes, who a lot of people may not know anything about. There was a great African-American arranger, composer by the name of Phil Moore. And Phil Moore went to MGM in the early 1940s. And he was one of the first, if not the, to be there on the staff of MGM. And Phil Moore worked with everybody, I mean, black and white. He was important in the careers of Lena Horne and Dorothy Dandridge, later Diane Carroll. But he also worked with Ava Gardner, with Marilyn Monroe. He was a coach, had his own practice. So this was another aspect of the film community. There were choreographers, there were agents, and there was very much, for Black Hollywood, there was a distinct part of town where all of these magnetic, talented personalities gathered. They mixed. They traded stories.
This is Central Avenue, right? This is Central Avenue in L.A. Tell us about that.
The great thoroughfare in Los Angeles for the African-American community was Central Avenue. And it was an absolutely glittering, dazzling boulevard. I mean, you had the great black nightclubs. At one time, there was the Apex. Later, there was Club Alabama. You had the cafes. You had the restaurants. You had the shops. And the jewel in the crown of Central Avenue was the Dunbar Hotel. And the Dunbar Hotel goes up in the late 1920s, and it stands there like a mighty fortress. And this was the place where all of the great African-American dignitaries and celebrities from out of town coming to Los Angeles, this is where they would stay. And many of the people I interviewed for the book, the old-timers who have been around, I mean, when they reminisced about the Dunbar, they said that, you know, you could go into the lobby of the Dunbar and you might see Duke Ellington there, or you might see Lena Horne or the Nicholas Brothers. But there was a very, very definite community.
Well, Black that's Hollywood what we're talking about. We want to hear more about
it. It's a mythic place and
we're going to hear more about it, Donald. We're a little short of time. We're going to come right back, though, and talk more about the African-American experience in Hollywood with my guest, Donald Bogle. We'll take your phone calls. You can give us a call at 800-989-TALK to talk with Donald Bogle as our conversation about Black Hollywood continues. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Before the breakdown, we were talking a little bit about some of the roles available, and certainly early on, those roles were limited. The film Cimarron won an Academy Award, actually, in 1931, but I suppose that's a good example of the kind of roles available to African-Americans at the time. We have a clip here in which actor Eugene Jackson plays Isaiah, a young black servant who wants to go to church with a white family.
You all dressed up fine for church meeting. So I agreed to dress myself up Sunday style.
That's right, Isaiah. We take it as a personal compliment. Why, you look finer than any of us.
I just fixed my toilet like you all.
Isaiah, would you like to have a real suit of Sunday clothes?
A Sunday suit for me to wear, for true?
Mm-hmm. I don't want you to go to that church meeting.
No.
You don't understand. Now listen close. I want you to do something important for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the house is all alone, see? I want you to go down there and keep watch till we come home from that church meeting. Patrol duty, that's what.
Patrol duty? Mm-hmm. Yes, sir, Marcy Yancey.
Now, you take this, and if anyone tries to break in, shoot.
I'll kill them dead.
Fine, and you get a new suit and boots besides. Now, scoot.
Yes, sir, I'm scooting.
So that's Eugene Jackson as Isaiah, the servant, with Richard Dix as Master Yancey. And is this what, Donald Bogle, what most of the African-American roles were like? This movie was done in 1931.
Yes, in many respects it is typical. I should say this, that, you know, there were more roles for African-Americans once there were sound films. There were many blacks working in silent films, but when the sound era came in, the industry opened up. And one of the things about the sound era is that, of course, Hollywood started making musicals, and they did bring from the East Coast a number of different black stars known as great entertainers. And there were always rumors, just rumors, that the Negro voice recorded better. And so you get people like Duke Ellington comes to Hollywood in the 30s, Ethel Waters, the late 1920s, Bill Bojangles Robinson, tapping comes. But most African Americans did end up with, certainly in those sound films, they did play these sort of dim-witted comic servants. And Eugene Jackson had been a child star. Actually, he had been in the old Our Gang series in silent films. He had worked quite a time. But no, the actors were very much limited with these types of roles. And I must say this, that when they played these roles in the 30s, certainly in the beginning, the African-American community was glad to see black actors up there on screen. Mm-hmm. They weren't always satisfied with what they did, but they were glad to see that that they were getting work. And so it became a struggle once actors were getting work to get better work and to see the roles change.
800-989-8255 is the number to call. Charlie's on the line from Wichita, Kansas. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. I'm calling from Hattie McDaniel's birthplace, and I was looking at an old Humphrey Bogart movie I borrowed from the library, and Sam McDaniel, Hattie's older brother, played Humphrey Bogart's valet. And it was a throwaway scene that I assumed in the South they could just cut it out, throw it away, put it back in when they sent the print back to Hollywood. But I pulled him up on the Internet Movie Database, and from 1928 to 1960, he had 198 credits.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
But basically spent his life as a train porter almost in movies.
Exactly.
Do you know anything about him outside of, I mean, how did
he? Well, I can tell you this. Yes. He was Hattie's older brother, and the McDaniel family, Sam, I believe, was the first one to actually get to Hollywood in the late 1920s.
Before you finish, let me point out that Hattie McDaniel played the Mammy in Gone with the Wind.
Yes,
so,
and she was the first African-American to win the Academy Award as Best Supporting Actress of 1939. But Sam comes first. Other members of the family come, and then Hattie comes. And Sam worked on radio in Los Angeles, and he did do these bit parts, sometimes supporting roles, for years. He and Hattie were close. He did live comfortably in Los Angeles, and he very much was a part of this black film colony. But Sam never got to he never got to achieve the kind of things that his sister Hattie did.
What was the transition? There was a transition then when African American roles became roles about real life in African America, African American life, rather than the stereotype.
Well, the shift really starts during the Second World War. And at that point, someone like Walter White, the executive secretary of the NAACP, he goes to Hollywood, he meets with industry leaders, and he wants to see a change in roles. I mean, during the Second World War, this is when black GIs are going abroad to fight for the freedom of others, and there are these questions about certain rights being denied them at home. And Walter White and others pressure the industry to do a different type of film with African Americans and different types of roles. And Lena Horne does become, as she herself has said, she does become the test case. She comes to Hollywood. She's not going to play maid roles, and she's the first black woman in Hollywood cinema to be fully glamorized and fully publicized when she signs with MGM Studios.
Listen to this. We've got a clip from Cabin in the Sky. This is a film done in 1943, and it's about African Americans with an all-black cast. This scene has actress Ethel Waters, who plays Petunia Jackson, and she's competing with Georgia Brown. She's played by Lena Horne for the attention of her husband, Joe Jackson, the husband who's played by actor Eddie Rochester. Cabin in the Sky.
Petunia, is this really you?
Mm-hmm. But not the same me who used to break her back busting suds over a tub for you.
Why, you're beautiful, Petunia.
Oh, save that sugar-coated talk for your girlfriend.
Where'd you get the clothes?
Don't you worry about that, Pops. The main point is you paying for them.
Of course I'll pay for them. I didn't realize...
And that ain't all I'm collecting before I'm through.
Don't talk like that, Petunia. You know I still love you.
Now, you just be a little more careful what you say to your wife in front of me.
Georgia, you keep out of this.
I'm speaking my mind.
And I ain't heard a sound.
Now, little Joy, you're just so dumb you can't see what she's after.
We're both after the same thing, but I'm still the wife and got the inside track.
So that's a clip from Cabin in the Sky in 1943. Don Bogle, you talked about the pressure on the studios to produce this kind of a movie, but who was the audience? Who was watching this movie?
Well, the interesting thing about Cabin in the Sky, you know, it was not made for a black audience. It was made for the mainstream audience. It had been successful on Broadway, and MGM felt that there might be an audience out there, that mainstream audience. Lena Horne has said she made two of these black cast films, both in 1943, Cabin in the Sky, Stormy Weather. These were films where she played roles. Usually, Lena Horne would just sing in a movie and disappear. But nonetheless, Lena Horne has said that the importance of these movies for her was that they were shown on army bases, and black GIs got to see the films and were very excited by seeing on screen some semblance of an African-American community. It's not that these movies are free of stereotypes, but they are moving forward. And the black GIs, well, they really took to Lena Horne. And Lena Horne became a pinup girl for GIs, much like Betty Grable and Rita Hayworth were for white GIs. So Cabin in the Sky had that kind of importance. And I think that, that generally the black audiences that did get to see Cabin and Stormy Weather, again, were happy to see some kind of black film coming out of the movie industry. Those films were still not enough. They both were musicals. These were not dramatic films talking about black life. So the industry still had to go forward, and this was just one step forward.
Let's go to the phones now. Audie is on the line from Portland. Hello, Audie.
Hi. It's great to get on the show. When I was in my early teens, which dates me, I saw Carmen Jones. And I just love that movie. And it seems to have disappeared. We have a sort of a art house movie theater downtown, and several years ago they showed a whole bunch of Carmen movies, and they didn't show Carmen Jones, and I was so disappointed. I haven't seen it since I was a teenager, and I just wondered if it's out on the...
What the heck is their problem? They're not showing Carmen Jones? And they're showing these Carmen movies? They've got a real problem.
I mean,
you have one of the great Carmens in movie history, Dorothy Dandridge, who was nominated for the Oscar as Best Actress of 1954. First time a black woman had been nominated in the leading actress category. Well, they've got a real problem. But Carmen Jones was available on cassette, and I think it is on DVD now, or about to come out on DVD. They also do show Carmen Jones sometimes on television. If you have cable, you get the Fox Movie Channel. And it seems to me, I believe they had shown it at some point on Turner Classic Movies. But that one you should be able to get. And, of course, when you talk about Carmen Jones, I mean, Dorothy Dandridge, really, we've been talking about Lena Horne, what happened to her, but actually, you know, Dorothy Dandridge in the 1950s is the one who then alters Hollywood movie history all over again with her Oscar nomination. And the fact that Dandridge and stars like Nat Cole and Sammy Davis Jr., they represent a close of the old black Hollywood in that they break down new barriers, and as far as the way that they lived and socialized, they operated in a more integrated Hollywood itself.
How is the social life changing? Oh, by the way, Audie, before I let you go, I just wanted to say that we did do some checking, and it is available. Carmen is available on DVD.
Oh, great.
So you can go find it. Thank you for your call. How is the social life changing, as you say, the end of the old black Hollywood and onto the new? What's happening to the social life?
Well, you know what happened socially. I mean, very much with the, you know, the way that people had to live. Blacks in Los Angeles originally lived in what was known as the East Side. We're talking about early 20th century. And they moved further and further west to, you know, to the West Side and further west and so forth. But what happens after the Second World War, I had mentioned these restrictive covenants that prevented whites from buying homes in certain areas. And those covenants were struck down. And Nat King Cole is a great example of what happened. Nat King Cole moved in the very late 40s to Hancock Park. And Hancock Park was a white area, beautiful homes, very, very exclusive. And many whites in that area did not want Nat King Cole and his wife Maria in there. And there were protests. There were all sorts of problems. But Nat King Cole and his wife Maria refused to move. They held on. And eventually, Nat King Cole was very much someone who was able to socialize very much with this larger Hollywood community, black and white. Not that he left the black community, he didn't, but it was more open. Dorothy Dandridge, with her ascension to stardom after Carmen Jones, Dorothy Dandridge moved into the Hollywood Hills, and this had been off limits in the past, and so did Sammy Davis Jr. One time Sammy lived right across the street from Dorothy Dandridge. So the social lives changed. Black stars like Dandridge and Nat King Cole, they always had their their gatherings with black friends and associates, but they also did deal, and stars do have to socialize in a certain way, with that larger community.
I'm talking with Donald Bogle, who is the author of Bright Boulevards, Bold Dreams, The Story of Black Hollywood. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio. You can join our conversation by calling 800-989-8255. And Donald, I want to take a call here from Carolyn, who is in Stowe, Ohio. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my question. I was curious regarding any black directors that might have come out of black Hollywood. My understanding was that there were some making independent films, but some of the films you've mentioned, like Cabin in the Sky, were made by or produced by white directors. Were there any rather famous?
Yes, they were. There were, and there were... pretty early on, actually, these were race movies. That's the way they've been termed, and they were made for black audiences. But there was a black director, Spencer Williams, who had been in Hollywood from the late 20s, directed movies like The Blood of Jesus and Go Down Death. There was an actor like Clarence Muse who wrote for the race movies. Outside of Hollywood, of course, there was Oscar Michaud, the African-American director, writer, producer. So there were some people who indeed were making these movies.
One of the interesting characters in your book, one of the stars that you talk about, is James Edwards, who comes on the scene about the time as Brando, and James Dean, and can play the role of the rebel, but Hollywood is not ready for this role to be played by a black man.
No, not at all. I mean, James Edwards is one of those, in a sense, a tragic figure. James Edwards really, when the images start to change after the Second World War, 1949, there are four films that are released that deal with the Negro problem or the Negro question, and that really look at race. We may find them dated today, but they're very important. A movie called Pinky, which dealt with a young black woman dealing with racism in the South. There was Lost Boundaries, Intruder in the Dust, dealing with racism. And there was Home of the Brave with James Edwards, who has to deal with racism within the American military. Now, James Edwards comes before Sidney Poitier. He was a very handsome man, and by all rights, I mean, most people thought he was going to be the great black dramatic star of the 50s. It didn't work out. And, you know, he was a rather political man. He was outspoken. And there were various stories that circulated about him that ended up, I think, had a great effect on his career. So he kept working. He also did write. But he didn't become the kind of star that he should have become.
I want to bring us up to date because things have certainly changed today. Here's Jamie Foxx, who's nominated for Best Actor in Ray and Best Supporting Actor in his film Collateral. Here's a clip from his role as the legendary Ray Charles.
You were the ones that taught me that making a record is business, and find the best business deal that you can. Now, 75 cents of every dollar and owning my own masters is a pretty damn good deal. Can you match it?
Ray, we would love to match it, but we just can't. I mean, that's a better deal than Sinatra gets.
So, Don Bogle, are we getting to the point where we will stop saying black actor and just say actor?
Well, I don't see anything wrong with black actor.
No, but I mean, do we have to make the distinction?
No, I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying, but I don't know. I think the industry, obviously, this year is historic with these five nominations, and I think it is important. It'll be interesting to see the outcome. I think that Hollywood still does have certain barriers that are there. We see these actors. We are in a place today where we have real these black superstars, Denzel Washington, Will Smith, I would say Morgan Freeman, Samuel L. Jackson, stars who command multi-million dollar salaries and that have large followings, black and white. We still really don't have black women there. And we need more black directors and writers being recognized by the Academy as well.
All right, Don, we're going to roll the credits on this segment, but thank you very much. Bright Boulevard.
Thank you, Frank.
Bold Dreams. Is the story. Don Bogle is the author of The Story of Black Hollywood. Coming up, we are going to talk to a senior U.S. intelligence official about the testimony today of Porter Goss before a Senate committee. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.